due to some violent content, parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It's 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for
due to some violent content, parental discretion is advised.
Radio show on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Oh, pardon me for just a moment, guys. We are having a technical issue with the Doc, and he's going to reboot and log back in. If you will bear with us for just a moment, I will put on some quick music that he's done just to keep you guys entertained. Here we go. Thanks for your patience, guys. Dr. Mathis is back with us. And so now we'd like to go to some topic-relevant music that he's got to play for us tonight. So anytime you're ready, Dr. Mathis, if you would. As always, thank you for that, and if you wouldn't mind, could please let us know what the name of the song was and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Okay, the name of the song was Can You Feel It, and it is a commentary on basically the myriad aspects of society that are mucked up, and the conflicting messages we get, and basically a message to the listener to hold on to his or her own core and not be influenced by what goes on around them. And the artist is me. It's another shameless self-promotional attempt.
Nothing wrong with that at all. Thank you for that. As Dr. Mathis mentions indirectly, tonight's episode is entitled Celebrity Charity, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Well, in keeping with our last session's uplifting, inspiring trivia on death, What a perfect topic for the holidays, right? Not.
Mm.
But despite that, they never really stopped me. So we're doing another one. This is kind of a quick biop on six or seven musicians who actually died on stage. So there's more of them than you think. So most of the folks who are familiar with any form of hard rock and heavy metal music are probably aware of who Daryl Abbott was, a.k.a. Dimebag Daryl, who was the lead guitarist and founding member of the metal band Pantera. And he was basically shot to death on stage during a performance of Damage Plan, which was the follow-up band after Pantera broke up. Daryl Abbott and his brother started Damage Plan with a different vocalist and the same bass player, Reb Brown. And there was some disgruntled, mentally unstable 25-year-old ex-Marine who had been discharged due to mental health issues, by the way. He basically, they were playing a club in Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, in 2004, a club I had been to before and while I was in Ohio, and just kind of went up and on stage and started shooting and ended up killing Daryl Abbott on stage along with a couple of other folks until he was finally also killed by the police. So, and I'm not talking the band. So,
oh, yeah.
The other person. Yeah, right, yeah.
Trash for mom.
Anyway, yeah, okay, I will spare the audience my sting invitations. So the other person I want to talk about, or another one I want to talk about, is a local to Atlanta, Gustav Berdland, better known to locals as Colonel Bruce Hampton, who was performing on stage one day after his 70th birthday in 2017, and a bunch of local and fairly well-known artists were celebrating his birthday, and he was playing on stage with the rest of the band. And it was literally the last song, no pun intended. And there was a person on stage doing a solo, guitar solo, and Bruce Hampton goes down on his knees in front of his amp, kind of bracing himself, and everybody thought it was kind of a stage act, like, oh, I'm not worthy, this kid's doing a great solo. And he was in the middle of a heart attack and subsequently died. Yeah, he had been around forever and a day. He is considered by locals as the godfather of the jam band scene, particularly here in Atlanta. So it was pretty much a shock to local folks. John Hation, better known as Sib Hation, and if folks are going, wait a minute, that name sounds familiar. Yep, sure does. He's one of the original. He is the original drummer for the band Boston. And he was playing with a side band called Dirty Water on a Legends of Rock cruise in 2017, where he had a heart attack on stage and died. Previously, he had been diagnosed with kidney cancer months prior, so I'm sure that did not help his condition any. But at any rate, he was on board and was playing for the show with the Legends of Rock band and had a heart attack on stage with the band Dirty Water during the cruise. Now, another known person, particularly to hard rock heavy metal folks, is Nick Menza. Nick was one of the original drummers. In fact, I think he is the original drummer for the band Megadeth, and played with them for a long, long, long time. Well, he had two side projects he was playing with, one of which was a band called OHM, and was playing on stage in California in 2016, and he too had a heart attack and dropped dead on stage. So we seem to be seeing a pattern here among rock folks and heart attack, which probably speaks to their lifestyle, just if I had to take a guess. Okay, so another one, Mark Sandman, who is probably not very known to our audience, and I actually only heard a couple of songs by this gentleman. He was the founder and bassist and vocalist for this sort of avant-garde, sort of jazz rock band called Morphine, who did some pretty weird things. Oh. And he was in Italy doing a music performance at a festival, and also died of heart failure in 1999. He was 46 years old. So I don't know if he was imbibing in various substances or what the story was. I didn't get the full dilly on him. But I was wondering why I hadn't heard anything from Morphine in a long time, and that would be why.
Now you know.
Okay, so I kind of a weird act guy, at least by my standards, but kind of a strange, unusual act guy, I'll just put it that way, who came to fame in the 60s and 70s was this character known as Tiny Tim, who performed right all the way up into the 60s, and he was doing a benefit show for the Women's Club of Minneapolis in 1996. I think it was November. And literally collapsed of a heart attack right after the show. And if anybody saw pictures. Yeah, and if you saw, you know, as a younger person, he was extremely slender. When I saw pictures of him, you know, around the time of his death, he was not a slender guy. So I don't know what happened to him. I don't know if he was getting treatment for something or if he just needed to step away from the food bar. And no offense when I say that, because a lot of guys seem to be suffering from that. As they get older, and I'm not sure if that's because they were receiving treatment for something. But anyway, he had a heart attack after collapsing on stage and died. I think he was 64, if I'm not mistaken. And finally, and these were in alphabetical order if people are wondering.
No.
Of course you would. So there's a French singer, Barbara Weldens, who in 2017 had just released her debut album, and everybody just thought she was the bomb, and it got a lot of critical praise from the critics and audience loved her, and she was on stage in France, her home country, and was performing, and it was right at the end of her performance, no pun intended, and there was some kind of freak electrical accident. She used to perform barefooted, and she stepped on a piece of malfunctioning electrical equipment and was literally shocked to death at 35.
God.
Yeah. So I would not have wanted to be present at that show. I sort of had images of, you know, the Phantom of the Paradise, if you've ever seen that movie where where the guy gets shocked on stage because the Phantom doesn't want him doing the singing part, and he, you know, shocks him on stage with a electrical bolt prop thing. So I had sort of had visions of that, of her doing that. It's just like, ugh, what a horrible end to a budding, promising career. So anyway, that's my story for this evening. Folks who died on stage, and at least they went out, I suspect, the way they wanted to go out. You know, if you had to go out and you're a musician, you definitely want to go out on stage. I don't know that you want to go out from a gunshot wound or an electrical shock, but, you know.
Or a jealous lover.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, dog. I mean, woof. Anyway, that's my daily this evening. And when we have reconvened this show next time, I will try to come up with something a little less depressing, since it'll be, I think, probably between Christmas and New Year's, if I'm not mistaken. So
yeah, next show is the 26th, so we definitely need to be a little more upbeat for everybody's new resolution.
So maybe I'll talk about people that get drunk on New Year's or something. which would be about 99% of America, but I digress.
Yes. All righty. So thank you for the stories. Always appreciated. And again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight Eastern Standard Time. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, so tonight's show is called Celebrity Charity. This is not just a holiday topic, but it is definitely most relevant around public holidays that focused on gift giving. Regardless of and apart from anyone's religious beliefs, the Christmas season is definitely one of the, if not the, most active holiday for gift giving, fundraising, and other charity work. Tonight, we want to look at a very specific aspect of fundraising and charity, and that is celebrity-driven charity benefits, donations, and fundraising events, etc. We will talk about some of the history of this practice, as well as its forms in the present day and in recent years. We will also talk about the motivations for the celebrities to be involved, as well as what is the psychology behind why this works. In other words, why are we more driven to donate when a famous person asks? How is the process any different from when a random person asks? Is it sentimentality? Is it feeding the feelings of esteem that many people get from connecting to iconic celebrities they admire? Vicarious fame? The spur of the moment driven by compelling media? We will also talk about some of the criticisms of the fundraising model, as well as notable examples of the process going sour at times. So let's talk about why this works on us and whether or not maybe this power could be harnessed by those who are not famous and still put towards charitable works. So this is how the discussion will break down. First, we'll get into the origins of the practice of celebrity charity and then how celebrity charity works. Some criticisms of celebrity charity events and fundraising and conclusions. And before we get started, I'll check in with you, Dr. Mathis, to see if there's anything you want to pipe in real quick before we get going here.
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay, fabulous. So first part, we want to talk about the origins of the practice of celebrity charity. So this first part is more of a history of the movement rather than the psychology yet, but it may help in understanding how we get to where we are now. So celebrities have been involved in fundraising and demonstrations of charity even further back than the advent of modern-day celebrities as we know them, which would be in the early to mid-20th century when mass media such as film, radio, television, newspapers en masse made it possible to create, promote, and maintain interest in celebrities as role models and social icons. Fair or not, the trend appears to be that society responds more productively to fundraising, promotional charitable acts, and other pledges when promoted and requested by notable celebrities. Now, the notion of benefit concerts is not even a modern one at all. Here is a further list of a few major celebrity fundraising efforts from the last few centuries, that's right, centuries, and into the modern day. They are unlikely to be a complete roster, but it does denote some of the more iconic events that contributed to the celebrity charity culture we have today, and it shows a timeline of the practice and how it changes tactics. So one of the first of its kind was back in 1749. My source for this is Wikipedia. In 1749, the composer George Friedrich Handel wrote his Foundling Hospital Anthem and put on annual performances of The Messiah to support an orphan's charity in London. Now, while many composers and performers of the time took parts in concerts to raise donations for charitable causes, it was also not unusual in the 18th and 19th centuries for musicians to stage performances to raise funds for their own professional work, such as Ludwig van Beethoven's 1808 Academy Concert. Although these were not charity fundraisers, they were fundraisers. Few decades go by. In 1918, there was a historic concert for the benefit of widows and orphans of Austrian and Hungarian soldiers. The historic concert for the benefit of widows and orphans of Austrian and Hungarian soldiers, really long title, guys. It was held at the Konzerthaus in Vienna. And that event actually was a one-time thing, and it was tied to World War I. So we have a bit of a gap for a few decades. And then in the 70s and early 80s, the practice became much more common, setting the stage for Band-Aid in December 1984. So in 1971, the concert for Bangladesh happened in August. It took place at Madison Square Garden in New York City and was conceived and produced by George Harrison. Performers included Harrison, Ravi Shankar, Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, Ringo Starr, Billy Preston, and Leon Russell, among others. 76 was a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. Amnesty International staged the first in what became its long-running Secret Policeman's Ball series of events raising funds for and awareness of human rights issues. 1979, in January, was a Gift of Song, the Music for UNICEF. The song, the Music for UNICEF concert, was held at the United Nations General Assembly and broadcast worldwide to raise money for UNICEF and mark the International Year of the Child. Performers included ABBA, The Bee Gees, Andy Gibb, Olivia Newton-John, John Denver, Earth, Wind & Fire, Rita Coolidge, Kris Kristofferson, Rod Stewart, and Donna Summer. The concert was the idea of impresario Robert Stigwood, the Bee Gees, and David Frost. In December of 79, the concerts for Campuchia was held. They were held at the Hammersmith Odeon and benefited the citizens of Cambodia who were victims of the tyrannical reign of dictator Pol Pot. In 1982 was a nuclear disarmament rally in June in New York City. 750,000 people marched from the UN to Central Park to protest nuclear weapons in what was probably the largest single protest in U.S. history at that time. New York City was shut down for the day. The concerts featured artists including Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, and Bruce Springsteen. The modern understanding of a benefit concert is of a large-scale popular event put on to support a charitable or a political cause. In the modern era, the first benefit concert is generally held to be the Concert for Bangladesh, a program of two events held at Madison Square Garden in New York that we just mentioned, organized by George Harrison and Ravi Shankar. In the earlier modern days of music and other celebrity-driven charity, there were things such as Danny Thomas promoting St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, and the even more famous Labor Day weekend, Jerry Lewis Muscular Dystrophy Telethons on television. In the 1980s, a new explosion of celebrity-driven charity events began, heralded by Band-Aid, Christmas 1984, by Bob Geldof of the Boomtown Rats, and Midge Ure of Ultravox, doing the song Do They Know It's Christmas, a charity for Africa, and then its sequel the next summer, Live Aid, in the following summer of 85, doing a song called Feed the World. Band-Aid gave this method a codified format just in time for the rise of MTV and cable television in major U.S. cities, thus guaranteeing an enormous audience across many time zones at once. Now, following Band-Aid came a flurry of causes springboarding off their success. So you can see that once they got this format down and everyone responded so well, this thing just exploded even further, and everybody was doing it. All the cool kids were imitating them. So immediately on the heels of all this, we had Farm Aid, September 85. The first Farm Aid concert was organized by Willie Nelson and John Cougar Mellencamp to raise money for family farmers in the United States and was held in Champaign, Illinois. There have been 19 Farm Aid concerts as of 2007. Right after that was Hearin' Aid, as in hearing aid, but it was Hear apostrophe N. This was a one-time collaboration of various individual hard rock and heavy metal artists in 85 to raise money for famine relief in Africa. This was done in May 85, orchestrated by Ronnie James Dio and members of his band. Next, the following year was Self-Aid in 1986. The Self-Aid concert was held in Dublin, Ireland, and aimed to highlight the chronic unemployment problem in Ireland at the time. Performers at the event included U2, Van Morrison, and the Pogues. The next concert was Conspiracy of Hope in the U.S. tour in June of 86. The Conspiracy of Hope U.S. tour of six rock concerts for Amnesty International. Performers included U2, Sting, Joan Baez, Lou Reed, Jackson Browne, the Neville Brothers, and at the final three concerts, a reunion of the Police. Next after that was Heartbeat 86, which was, well, it was in March. It was actually before that, but same general time frame. The Heartbeat 86 concert was held near Birmingham, England, to raise money for the Birmingham Children's Hospital. The Wall, live in Berlin, 1990. Roger Waters raised a memorial fund for disaster relief. A live concert performance by Roger Waters and numerous guest artists of the Pink Floyd studio album The Wall. The show was held in Berlin on July 21, 1990, to commemorate the fall of the Berlin Wall 8 months earlier. Last on the list, the Freddie Mercury tribute concert, April 20, 1992. The Freddie Mercury tribute concert was organized by the remaining members of Queen, which took place at Wembley Stadium, London, to pay homage to their deceased lead singer, Freddie Mercury, and to raise money for the Mercury Phoenix Trust, a fund for victims of AIDS. Among the performers were David Bowie, Elton John, Metallica, Guns N' Roses, Def Leppard, Extreme, Robert Plant, Liza Minnelli, Roger Daltrey, and George Michael. One of these things is not like the other ones. Love you, Liza, but it's not really your genre. The list goes on and on with benefits from 9/11, natural disasters, war and famine victims, and many more causes up to the current day. The format has not deviated very far from the basic mega concert parameters of Band-Aid. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, to see if there's anything that you would like to add about that before we go to the next part.
Yeah, the other one you might want to think about that's done on a pretty regular basis is the Who. The remaining members of the Who do a concert pretty frequently for teenage cancer, to raise money for teenage cancer, and they're usually joined on stage by a variety of folks. And I think the latest incarnation has Eddie Vedder with them and a variety of other folks coming in.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's
yeah.
Good to know. And that wasn't on the list that I had, so that's good to add that in. Thank you for that.
Yeah, actually, Oasis was one of the earlier cancer benefits.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so let's go to the next part where we talk about how celebrity charity works. And by this, I mean how it works on us, essentially. And there's a little bit about how it functions as well. So let's talk about how celebrity involvement in charity changes our giving behavior. And this first article that I want to read to you guys is a little bit of insight on that. It's an article called The Truth About Celebrity Benefit Concerts by Dorothy Pomerantz. And this was written in January 2010 for Forbes.com. She mentions a concert in here, which was going on in late 2009, 2010. So Friday night's Hope for Haiti Now concert was a huge success, raising $57 million so far for organizations like Oxfam America, the Red Cross, and UNICEF that are working to help victims of the January 12th earthquake. Organized by actor George Clooney and musician Wyclef Jean of the Fugees, the event was a star-studded bi-coastal concert featuring performances from U2, Alicia Keys, and Bruce Springsteen, among many others. We've come to expect celebrities to rally with a big concert event in the wake of a tragedy. Benefit concerts have been in vogue since 1985's Live Aid, which raised $245 million for famine relief in Ethiopia. At the same time, it's natural to feel a bit cynical watching Madonna in a fancy leather jacket with a face seemingly approved by thousands of dollars worth of plastic surgery, singing and asking viewers to donate small sums to help people in Haiti who are hurt, homeless, and starving. She's clearly rich. According to our last Celebrity 100 list, Madonna earned $110 million between June 2008 and 2009. Why doesn't she just donate some of her own millions to those suffering in Haiti? And I have a personal note here. Why is the assumption that she hadn't donated her own money? Certainly also, her own time and effort is money in her line of work. Back to the article. According to Paul Skirvish, director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College, by appearing in the Hope for Haiti Now concert, a star like Madonna can raise more money and create more happiness than she could have by just donating on her own. Skirvish called this kind of fundraising catalytic philanthropy. Instead of just opening their own wallets, celebrities can inspire hundreds of thousands of others to give. Benefit concerts are also a good way to raise money quickly. It doesn't take much work to get artists to perform together as long as the organizers can find the right venue. The recent concerts for Haiti in New York and Los Angeles took place just 10 days after the earthquake struck. Plus, the charities can continue to raise money even after the concert is over. An original song called Stranded, in parentheses, Haiti Mon Amour, which was performed by Bono, The Edge, Jay-Z, and Rihanna during the Haiti concert, is now the most downloaded song on iTunes, and the CD version of the concert is the biggest one-day album pre-order in iTunes history. And note, this was as of 2010. Here is some more information. This is not the article anymore. This is something separate. It's information on Paul Skirvish, who has extensively studied this specific topic. Like, this is his area of expertise. So I wanted to get into him a little bit. So the efficiency of celebrity charity is explained by the theory of catalytic philanthropy designed by Paul Skirvish. Paul Skirvish is professor of sociology and director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy, CWP, at Boston College. Skirvish served as a Fulbright Scholar for the 2000 to 2001 academic year at University College Cork in the area of research on philanthropy. For the 99 to 2000 academic year, he was appointed Distinguished Visiting Professor at the Indiana University Center on Philanthropy. He has been selected 5 times to the Nonprofit Times Annual Power and Influence Top 50, a list which acknowledges the most effective leaders in the nonprofit world. One of his noted papers on this topic is Giving and Getting, Philanthropy as a Social Relation, which is written by Paul G. Skirvish and Susan A. Ostrander. His thesis explains that it is more beneficial to a cause that celebrities do not contribute by only donating their money, but by participating in events like benefit concerts. That way, stars can inspire hundreds of thousands of others to give. The presence of celebrities can draw criticism, but that is outweighed by the benefits. Some argue that pop stars only take part in charity to improve their public image. That arguably may be a motivation, but their participation can be essential to the event's success. Celebrities not only promote catalytic philanthropy, they can produce an effect some call Geldofism, which I found really funny. The mobilization of pop stars and their fans behind a cause, quote unquote. Therefore, because of their visibility, celebrities are used by organizers as a mean to gain support to the cause at hand. The source for that is Wikipedia. And for any of our listeners who might have been confused by that term, let me remind you, as I mentioned in the previous discussion, Bob Geldof of the Boomtown Rats was one of the co-founders of Band-Aid, and that's why they call it that. Because what he did kind of was unprecedented up until that time, at least in modern music. So the next article I want to read to you is called Large Scale Benefit. Oh, pardon me. It's not an article. It's from Wikipedia. My bad. So, quote, large scale benefit concerts attract millions of viewers and are usually broadcast internationally. As powerful means of mass communication, they can be highly effective at raising funds and awareness for humanitarian causes. Media scholars Dayan and Kantz classify benefit concerts as media events, shared experiences that unite viewers with one another and their societies. In fact, in their book, Media Events, The Live Broadcasting of History, the authors suggest that the song synonymous with the Live Aid benefit concert, We Are the World, might as well be the theme song for media events, as it nicely encompasses the tone of such occasions. These ceremonies or media events are so all-encompassing that there's nobody left to serve as out-group. Davin and Kantz define media events as shared experiences that unite viewers and call their attention to a particular cause or occasion. They argue that media events interrupt the flow of people's daily lives and that such events create a rise of interpersonal communication or fellow feeling, quote-unquote. Furthermore, they propose that media events transform the ordinary role of the viewer into something more interactive, where they adhere to the script of the event. All these principles of media events are true of benefit concerts. Benefit concerts interrupt the routine of people's lives because they occur, in most cases, for only one night or for one weekend. And there are some that are a series, but furthermore, they are broadcast as television spectacles that interrupt the regularly scheduled programming on a given television network. Often this kind of announced interruption has television viewers discussing the event with others beforehand, generating excitement around the event. Moreover, benefit concerts encourage audiences to adhere to their script, such as by phoning in donations or signing an online pledge. Dayan and Kantz suggest that media events are an expression of, quote, a neo-romantic desire for heroic action, meaning that media events produce leaders who inspire collective action with belief in, quote, the power of the people to change the world. Benefit concerts, therefore, have the potential to raise enormous sums of money for a cause because of the parasocial interaction that occurs between the performing celebrities, the leaders, and the spectating fans, the people. Dan Lally describes parasocial interaction as the apparent familiarity between media personalities and audiences. Seeing a favorite celebrity support a cause can influence fans to support the same cause, not because the cause is significant to the fans, but because it seems significant to the artist. To feel connected to a celebrity, fans are likely to participate in activities the celebrity considers important. For example, if a benefit concert starred unknown musicians performing songs for unknown people in Africa, the incentive for viewers to donate would be minimal. Bob Geldof, the founder of Live Aid, and also Band Aid, is aware of the need for familiarity and parasocial interaction on behalf of the viewer. When criticized for not inviting enough African performers to play at Live Aid, of which the main purpose was famine relief for Africa, Geldof commented that only popular musicians were invited to play at the show because unfamiliar artists would cause viewers to lose interest and switch off. In seeing the familiar face of their beloved artist on stage endorsing a cause, fans feel more compelled to support the cause. And sadly, this is not the article now, this is my comment. Sadly, as unfair as that is, Geldof was probably correct. And we'll talk a little bit more about this and other critiques in Section 3. I'm going to pause here real quick and check in with Dr. Mathis before I go to the next part, see if you want to add anything. I'm sorry, one more time. I had a microphone problem. Oof. Okay. I am having a difficulty hearing your mic at the moment. I'm going to go ahead to the next section. If you want to cycle in and call back in, it might correct that, but I'll leave that choice up to you. So the next part I want to talk about is, why does this work on us? Those in a position to give or donate are likely to be living even at least a modest lifestyle that is disconnected from whatever situation needs attention, be it poverty, natural disasters, catastrophic medical needs, homelessness, and so on. When a charity organizes any kind of intervention, a lot of the literal and emotional labor of vetting a cause for if the need is legitimate and how is the best way to give meaningful help is done for us. And we find this a relief, so we gravitate to such charities and other entities. A large number of everyday people are not necessarily charitable by their default nature. We read occasional internet tales about a poor or struggling person performing incredible acts of charity. But let's be honest here. We most love these stories because we realize that they are unusual. Some of this goes back to the psychology of our relationship with celebrity itself. We hold up famous creators of art and fantasy as role models, or at least, quote, cool people to emulate. The celebrity charity model feeds into that esteem boost mechanic, as well as a bonding feeling of tribe that commonly is fed by things like grand, theatrical, dramatic shows and presentations, where thousands of people sing the same song together that they know by heart. This validation makes people compliant and seeking to be mutual with the crowd, and so out come the wallets or anything someone asks. It is a form of perceived status and accomplishment to be part of such iconic events. Celebrity charity, even in its more authentically altruistic forms, takes advantage of that phenomenon. We also receive praise from the charity, which makes us feel better about ourselves, especially if the praise is presented as the celebrity noticing and thanking us personally. Additionally, many, if not most people, are followers, not instigators. They're willing to chip in if someone else makes it extremely easy, almost lazy and mindless, to donate something. It's low risk and low effort, and frankly, many people will only donate if you hold their hands in this way. There is also a lingering cultural trope that those who are generous will find that in times of hardship, others will reciprocate. This encourages people to be less anonymous about their giving, in hopes that this adage proves true. Doubtless, we like to think people choose to donate because they value the act, but psychologically, this is somewhat rare, even if they tell us otherwise. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you have any comments.
No, I'm just going to say that, can you hear this okay?
I can. You're great.
Okay. Yeah, I keep losing my internet connection on my end. I don't know what the heck that is. What I was going to say is I agree with the Geldof comment. I think if you had people on there who nobody knew, they wouldn't be donating. I mean, that's just the reality of realities. It's pragmatic. If you want money, which is the whole point of that, you get people who people know.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, that was something we're going to get into a little more in Section 3 as well. That was one of the biggest points of contention about the Live Aid project was the lack of participation from African celebrities of whatever stripe.
Right.
But, yes, you know, unfortunately, this is true, and it would be nice to be able to include people of the demographic you're helping. But if you want to raise money to really do some help for them, then sadly you have to cater to this sort of stuff because fair or not, fickle or not, that's what makes the audience open up the wallet. So,
yep. That's true.
There we go. All righty, so let's go to Section 3. And this is some criticisms of celebrity charity events and fundraising. So celebrity involvement in fundraising, while it can provide visibility and donor attachment that other methods do not, is not without its issues and criticisms. Sometimes because of the level of fame of those involved, events and causes can get sucked into the micromanaging of image and publicity that is common in regular for-profit ventures, and often at the expense of some aspects of the original supported cause. If members of the cause or their representatives are not considered marketable or well known enough to get mass media attention and love, they sometimes can be minimized or even left in the wings in favor of big names and flashy presentations. And these are some notes from the Wiki article on benefit concerts. Quote, furthermore, the success of benefit concerts is tightly related to the quality of entertainment offered by them. To gain space, and by this they mean concert space, somebody willing to cough it up, and legitimization in the media, benefit concerts must have a large audience, the kind of large crowd attracted by famous music stars. Bob Geldof himself responded to criticisms about the lack of African artists on the Live Aid by stating that although these musicians produce great works, they do not sell many albums. And for the sake of reaching as many people as possible, his concert had to include only popular artists. Finally, the quality of entertainment is key to the creation of a public sphere where discussions about the concert's cause can occur. The better the entertainment, the more people watch the concert, and thus the more people become aware of the cause. Furthermore, the music played in the concerts can lead spectators to interconnect and become more likely to act towards the cause. According to a theory by Jane Bennett, when people sing in the presence of other people, and that happens in benefit concerts, they become connected to each other and are much more likely to work together towards a goal. Critics also say that benefit concerts are just a way for the rich West to forgive itself by helping the poor in distress. These critiques argue that concerts like Live Aid, quote, rob Africans of agency, reinforces Western ethnocentrism, and racisms, and see famine as a natural disaster rather than a political issue, end quote. And the source for this was by T.V. Reid, who's an author in 2001, an article called Famine, Apartheid, and the Politics of Agitpop, Music as Anti-Colonial Discourse. And this was in Cercle's Revue Pluridisciplinaire du Monde Anglophone, number 3, RILM Abstracts of Music Literature. That's where that comes from. Separately, criticisms against benefit concerts go further than just criticizing the intentions of the celebrities involved. Some argue that benefit concerts are a wrong response for tragedies because the atmosphere involved in them is hardly one of mourning. And that's from Paul Wells' 2005 Songs for the Suffering in McLean's MAS Ultra School edition. Separate quote. Further criticism comes from those who argue that Geldofism, again with that term, turns celebrities into the only legitimate spokespeople for a cause, robbing the NGOs of the possibilities to speak up for a cause. And this is from Seth Haig, John Street, and Heather Savigny in 2008, The Voice of the People, Musicians as Political Actors, from Cultural Politics, Bloomsbury Publishers. Another problem with celebrity charity is nonprofits and other charitable business entities established by celebrities. Many of them do marvelous work, but sometimes they benefit the celebrity by implying an image of them that is somewhat misleading in some cases, yet for which they still reap the goodwill image. And this is an article called The Truth About Celebrity Giving by David K. Randall for Forbes in 2008. And he says, why would a celebrity set up a foundation in the first place and not just write a check to a charitable organization? The simple answer is that they may not know who to write the check to, says Dr. Leslie Lankowski, a professor with the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University. But that's not often the sole benefit, he says. PR is also high on the list. The charitable purpose might be to give scholarships, but it also serves as a vehicle for promoting the celebrity's image, he says. Foundations might even provide an easy way to give a relative a place to work, he says. Another murky area in the world of celebrity giving is that while celebrities can host things like golf tournaments for fundraising, they're not always donating their own money. Quote, celebrities can have the image of being charitable without necessarily giving, Sandler said. Mark Pollock, who heads the Giving Back Fund, takes offense at celebrities who put their names on foundations but not their own money into them. Quote, we think it's perpetuating a fraud upon the public, he says. Our listeners can now see how some of these sour situations can ruin the reputation of a cause. Many people do not do their homework and might abandon a cause based on gossip. Many may become distrusting after giving to a cause based on celebrity request, just to find out later that things were not as originally portrayed. There's a specific resentment we carry for this kind of betrayal because of the cultural icon status that played into our engagement and sacrifice. So, Dr. Mathis, I have a couple specific questions for you relating to this, and feel free to answer these however you want.
Okay.
So could we get people to experience the same feelings of mutuality and charity towards causes while not relying so heavily on celebrities to drive the connection? Is there any way to separate the two? Or should we not do this because one has to admit that, despite its failings, the tactic works? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the reality is people are not going to donate unless they know the act and like the act. So it can't even be acts they know. It has to be acts that are popular, right? Because there were a lot of non-African acts, let's say, on the criticism of Geldof. There was a lot of non-African acts that didn't show up at that concert benefit because they weren't popular.
Yeah.
So if you really want people to donate, you've got to get performers that are hot in the public eye. I mean, that's just the reality of realities. Now, you can kind of merge the two if you want by bringing some – I mean, they could have – ostensibly, they could have taken some African actors and paired them and done sort of a jam on stage, and that would have been cool, right? But if you don't have name acts, you're not getting the money. That's the bottom dog online. And I think anybody who believes otherwise is a moron. I don't think it's going to happen. And I agree that if you're donating, if performers who get, a boatload of money to do their thing are donating their time, they are donating money. It's the same thing with the what's the concerts that Clapton puts on every year? The Crossroads concerts.
Oh.
Which he puts on to raise money for his Crossroads Drug Rehabilitation Center. And the performers donate their time for that too. The Allman Brothers and B.B. King and, you know, ZZ Top and a bunch of folks show up to those things. They're not going to, those folks aren't going to show up to a concert of people they don't know. That's just a bottom line.
Yeah. So do you think that it's not, like, the celebrities are going to gain sort of attention that it really isn't possible to recreate any other way? Is that basically the truth of it? Yes, I see. I have a muse here. I'm sorry. I have a little four-legged visitor. Dr. Mathis, did you hear my question?
No, I missed it when you were playing with the cat or whatever.
Yeah, I think she knocked my microphone. So I was saying that if I'm understanding your assessment of this, that the celebrity connection is kind of unique and it plays on something we can't really recreate without using somebody like that. It's not something that is really portable to everyday applications. Is that kind of your take on it?
Yeah, I think it has to be a popular celebrity. It can't be a has-been that isn't in there anymore, or it can't be some, you know, minor celebrity, and unless you're going to mix the minor celebrity with a major celebrity.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, do you have any theories on, like, what is that for us that we respond in that way and we're kind of stuck on it?
I think it's a projective identification thing. You know, you see somebody on stage that you like and that you would love to be like, or you'd like to be in their presence or be buddies with them or hang out or, you know, just shake hands with them or get an autograph or whatever, and it's kind of a projective identification thing. I mean, I can tell you as a musician, when I see folks on stage that I like, right, I'm picking up riffs from them, if they're guitar, bass players, whatever. I'm picking up riffs from them. I'm watching their hands. I'm looking at the equipment they use. I'm looking at the settings on the. I mean, that's why I take binoculars to concerts, so I can cheat and see the stuff they're doing, right? Yeah. And, you know, and so it's kind of a way to, if you know, it's kind of like the on Silence of the Lambs when they, you know, maybe, I think it was Silence of the Lambs. Might be that one or the no, it's the Red Dragon. I take that back. Where they say to him, "Why do you think this guy's going to keep doing what he's doing?" And you know, the FBI agent says, "Well, because it makes him God. You wouldn't want to give that up, would you? You know, if you do the same things God does, you become God. Well, if you play the same riffs that somebody like B.B. King can play, or Eric Clapton, or Jimmy Page, or you know, anybody, you know, Slash, whomever your idol is." You sort of, for a minute, you become that person, you take on that person's mantle, and that's very rewarding for people. And so you see that person playing, and you're hearing the music that you like, it's going to put you in a good mood. You're probably going to be predisposed to give some money.
Got it. Okay, so pretty much the conclusion is that there really is no way to separate this out, and Bob Geldof latched onto something that is kind of a permanent fixture in this mechanic. I mean, we have fundraising of a lot of different sorts, but I don't think the celebrity fundraising, that genie cannot go back in the bottle, I don't think.
No, and, you know, and he was knighted for that, by the way, as you probably know.
I did not, but I'm not surprised. I was unaware, and good for him.
Absolutely. I mean, he started something that no one had done on that scale of magnitude before, ever. And he really did a shoot ton of work to get those guys to play together and to do the things and to coordinate stuff. And Phil Collins was flying back and forth between two stages on two continents to do the thing and played on both continents. So, you know, it took a lot of finagling to get stuff done. So, you know, you got to give those organizers their due. And I think that, you know, for Geldof to come off and to pull this off, he had, you know, he was in the public eye at the time also with the Boomtown Rats and some of his own work. So folks knew him and they were much more willing to come in and do stuff. And, you know, I just think that it's what you have to do. And you can pair some local folks with that, you know, if you wanted to pair, let's say you're doing a benefit for folks in Guatemala, I'm just making this up, you know, and you want to get some Guatemalan musicians on stage and do a jam with some of the other more professional, you know, well-known professional folks, not more professional, the more well-known professional folks. Yeah, great. I think that's a great idea, and you could certainly do that, and then you could expose people to that kind of music and open people up a little bit. But if you just put those folks on stage, people are going to go, who are these bozos? No matter how talented they are, and I'm not suggesting they're not talented, because you know, there's a lot of folks I have never heard of, and I see them on stage, and I go, holy moly. You know,
yeah.
I had no clue. And the first time I saw Robert Randolph play, who is an amazingly stellar slide player, lap steel player, steel pedal player, excuse me, was at the Clapton's Crossroads concert. And I'm hearing this black guy playing a pedal steel, which is, you know, usually associated with either Hawaiian music or, you know, country music. And I'm seeing this guy play a pedal steel like a slide guitar and doing all these wah pedals. I'm like, holy moly. I mean, he is, he's like a force of nature. So I got introduced to him, unbeknownst to who he was, but he was on stage playing with Clapton. So I'm like,
okay, then,
can't be too bad. and that was an understatement. Yeah. So I got introduced to Robert Randolph, and I was like, oh, and I started listening to some of his stuff, and I'm like, oh, this guy's really good. So it was kind of a nice entree for me, and for me to get involved with these things as a listener, as an audience person. You know, it's really cool because I get introduced to some artists that I had no clue existed. And, you know, Clapton brings some people on there that are kind of like obscure folks. He had a guy from India on there doing some kind of weird stuff. I don't know what he was doing on an instrument he created himself, which is kind of a cross between the guitar and the sitar. And the guy was fabulous. And I'm looking at that stuff going, God, this is awesome. And the people in the audience were clearly enjoying it, but he had this person sandwiched in between really famous acts.
Yeah.
So I think that was a night. I think Clapton has kind of done sort of the blend thing, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I think that was a wise move because you have something amazing and memorable, but it's sandwiched in between names you recognize so that you don't lose it. I think that was a good move.
Yeah, and then it opens up people to listen to their music, and then they're going to patronize their music, which is going to give money back to the culture. I mean, it's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up with the conclusions, kind of summarize for you guys what we've all been talking about. So in summary, celebrity charity has some aspects to it above and beyond everyday fundraising and charity events. It adds a public figure aspect to the donor dynamic, which can be used to elicit participation where one might not normally get it. It plays into our fascination with famous people and wanting to connect to that fantasy image to boost our self-esteem. It plays into our desire to be part of an enormous and iconic event and to connect with community. There are some flaws to the model because of the capricious nature of celebrity image and publicity, but is nevertheless a quite effective method of fundraising. And I'll check in with you, Dr. Mathen, and see if there's anything that you would like to add here.
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. So it is very close to midnight, guys. So this more or less concludes our show on celebrity charity. And we hope that our listeners now better understand how this method works and can recognize their own relationship with the process. Maybe in this season of giving and throughout the coming year, listeners will actively choose to engage with charitable projects and charities closer to their communities or that directly impact those that they love. Is there any closing remarks that you would like to add before we close up here?
No, I'm good, and I think that was a great summary. This is the season to do that. If you want to share some of your blessings, this is a great time of year to do that.
Yes, absolutely. And also, you know, to be pragmatic about it, end of the year is a good time to get that tax deduction done before the window closes. So,
well, and the other thing I would say to people is, you know, if you know, you don't have to just donate money, you can donate your time, you can work at a homeless shelter or feeding the homeless, you can donate old clothing or there's lots of ways to be magnanimous and, you know, help a bunch of people without necessarily coming out of your pocket. And then you can take those things off your taxes. So it's a win-win, folks.
Good to know. I actually did not know that you could put the, you know, donation of time and effort on your taxes. I did not know it was a thing.
You can't take the time and effort, but you can't take the time and effort, but you can take clothing and canned goods and any of that, any material stuff that you donate.
Material items,
all that's Yeah, all that is take-offable, if you will. Your dad's, you know, declarable on your taxes. But to me, donating your time and giving back to the community, and in fact, this radio show, and I hate to sound, you know, magnanimous myself because I'm not, but let's just be honest here. But part of my desire to do this radio show was to give back to the public a service, since I, you know, make money off my services from the public and take from the community in a sense. I might get my rewards in the community. I felt like this was kind of a way for me to give back to the community at large and reach folks that I might not reach before. And maybe something I do or say touches somebody, or something, you know, that you bring up in your articles and your research, people go, oh, shoot, I had no clue about that. And you help educate somebody and make their life better. And that's part of it. I mean, I know it sounds corny, but that's part of the reason I do this radio show. Because none of us are getting paid, including you. And you do a lot of work on this show, which I'm really grateful for. But, you know, we all do this as a public service. We're not getting paid for this. And it's to benefit folks in some way and maybe touch somebody's life. And certainly none of us are, you know, Jimmy Pages or Eric Clapton's or Rob Geldof's, but, you know, we do what we can do in our small manner. And what I would suggest to the public is to keep that in mind, that you can always make a difference with folks, even if it's just small difference, and even if it's in your community and not known nationally, you know? And
yep,
that's something that all of us can do.
Absolutely. And the nice thing about this particular format and what we do is it's shareable, and it can have legs on its own, because it will be out on the internet with keywords, and it will sit there until somebody needs it. And, you know, you and I might be in bed in our pajamas and somebody needs to talk about suicide at 3 a.m, and maybe they'll pull up a podcast, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all righty. So it is a little after midnight. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and our sponsor, NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you, who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys back here in 2 weeks on Wednesday, December 26th, which is Boxing Day. Give something nice to your service people and the postman and all that kind of stuff. 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows, which are coming up soon in the next couple of days. Monday, December 17th, Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega, 7 Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern. Saturday, December 22nd, Roger Noriega and Return to Battlestar Galactica at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and 8 a.m., and 11 a.m. Eastern. And Monday, December 24th, Christmas Eve, which will be Monday Night in America's Rockin' Christmas Eve at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern. Please look for us at The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Sorry, guys, it's been a very long day. So thank you, guys. Good night, everybody, and rock on. Thank you.